Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor George Siemens in this episode. George has had a long interest in learning technologies and network learning. His work in connectivism and MOOCs and his ongoing work in analytics and learning theory are very well known in online learning circles and continue to influence practice. So I'm talking now with George Siemens. George is Professor and Executive Director of the Learning, Innovation and Networked Knowledge Research Lab at the University of Texas, Arlington. And at the time of interview, he's serving as Professor and Director of the Centre for Change and Complexity in Learning at the University of South Australia. George has an international reputation as an innovator and keynote. And George, it's great to be talking with you.
Hey, Mark. It's great to catch up and always a pleasure to chat.
Great. Can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
Sure. Well, by way of a very, very quick background overview, my background initially was at Red River College, where I first started in higher education. And from there, I ended up moving into a range of a few different roles. I was early on in the conversation of digital learning on campus. And as a result of that, we had a chance to early on explore how people worked with technology, how it impacted student performance, and so on. And that led into, while I was at Red River College, I started my master's and then rolled into a PhD program. And then I shifted over to University of Manitoba, where with a colleague, Peter Tittenberger, and I, we ran the Center for Learning Technologies. And our basic focus there was much like I was doing at Red River, but at a slightly different scale, which was how do you use technology to improve, guide, impact the learning process for students, and hopefully in the long run, influence student success. It was at Red River College where I wrote a paper to your second point around publications, but I wrote a paper on looking at network learning specifically through the lens of connectivism. And that was something that gained some attention with individuals who I think similarly experiencing that there's a bit of fragmentation happening with learning technologies. And that was influencing who had control. And a lot of that control was starting to shift to the end user, namely the student. And then at that point, shortly after that, I ended up heading out to University of Manitoba. While I was at University of Manitoba, I ended up going out to Athabasca University, which was out west coast. And at Athabasca, I was there in the, it's similar to Open University UK. It's primarily an open university system that addresses the needs of students who are more adult learners, who are getting a master's or PhD level, even bachelor's level, learning online. And it's a publicly funded university, and it's one of really quite an innovative university system. And then from there, I made my jump down to University of Texas, and from University of Texas now to University of South Australia. So I have a role at UTA and now with the Center for Change and Complexity here at University of South Australia. So that's a quick background and paper-wise areas of interest, connectivism, some early work in MOOCs and in learning analytics. And so for somebody who's looking at my Google Scholar, those would probably be the main profiles or publications that they would see come up.
Excellent. So you've glossed over quite a bit there. You've also, of course, keynoted across multiple countries. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So one of the things that was interesting being early on in trying to explore how do technologies impact how we learn. And my early focus was on the idea of connectivism and network learning, as I mentioned, and in a number of ways, that's sort of what got me on, for lack of a better word, the keynote circuit. Yeah. And as a result of that, there was, I think, a lot of individuals around the world at a similar point to what I was, which was trying to understand how do we use this growing, influential set of resources, whether it's hardware such as, not quite at the early stage, but mobile phones and smartphones, but and software such at that point, it was more Web 2.0 and similar topic areas. So how do we use these in a meaningful way? And the fact that the technologies produced a power change in classroom and in learning settings, and that power change was essentially from the teacher controlling the curriculum and the content and the resources to the student having much more control over her learning than she might have had previously. That was the shift. And so I think a lot of groups were interested in what this was. And by groups, I mean universities, colleges, schools, professional groups and organizations. And that's how I started doing the keynote circuit. And I've been, you know, very blessed to been able to travel to you know, a number of regions around the world over the last 15 to 20 years. And I've met colleagues from corporate learning to government to military to K-12 primary secondary school systems to, you know, primarily higher education, but a pretty full spectrum. And I've been able to see what's going on in terms of innovation in regions that go from you know, large Chinese cities such as you know, inland such as Wuhan and you know, on the shore, you know, more on the coast, but Beijing and Guangzhou and Hangzhou and Shenzhen and you know, through Latin American countries through to, you know, African regions, Europe, Australia. Obviously, I've been in New Zealand a number of occasions and so on. So. Yeah. That's a little bit of the background from a keynote end. And I think the main thing that struck me was just how global the awareness is that there's something structurally and fundamentally different when you introduce these tools of control into a classroom setting.
Great. And that sort of segues nicely into the next question about the ideas and themes your work has provided. Could you give us a bit of an overview of some of those key themes that have come through your keynotes and that have taken you so far over the years?
Well, a lot of the themes, I mean, when I look at it early on, it was about trying to understand what does technology do? And the what does technology do question was largely centered on who's getting control that didn't have control before, and how does that influence or change the overall conversation of what's going on in, you know, in society and what's going on in a range of different domains and topic areas. So it wasn't only education, because the interesting effect of these technologies was that the walls started to blur between a university campus or a classroom, and how does that begin to impact what you're doing outside of that environment. And so it wasn't exclusively confined to that physical space of learning, but it was really anywhere and everywhere. And so suddenly technology wasn't only, from my end, a learning question, but there's a number of social implications. So much of the early theme was around that experience, the influence of technology from a learning end and from a society end. And primarily the lens I looked at was around networks and how networks are impacting and enabling those opportunities.
Yeah.
Then probably mid 2000s to 2007, 2008, there was a bit of a shift where it went from sort of theorizing and trying to understand the dynamics of technology to looking more at the application of it. And at that point, I spent quite a bit of time trying to, and we're this together working with a colleague, Stephen Downs, sort of culminating in a course that we ran in 2008. And our focus was around how do we end up with, you know, with people having an experiential relationship to this changed way of learning and developing knowledge. And that experiential relationship was really a power structure or a power change. And so that was the first outcome in the form of what we eventually called the Massive Open Online Course. And the Massive Open Online Course then produced gained a fair bit of attention and recognition. I guess the term that was used at the time was that it was a MOOC, and it resulted in a fair bit of impact and adoption, really, you know, around the world as individuals now in regions from across the U.S., which is a major provider of these platforms, through China, which has their own platform, but has right now has probably the largest MOOC taking base in the world. And so that was a key area of focus. Now, with MOOCs, though, there was the follow-up benefit, which is that MOOCs produced a significant amount of data. And it's this production of data that results or makes an impact in being able to analyze what's happening from a learning lens. And that was the foray into learning analytics and how we begin to make sense of our world through these data sources that are produced as we engage in any kind of a digital setting. And I'd say more recently, I'm much more interested in trying to understand a lot more around the affects, the emotion, the social dimensions, the beingness dimensions of learning. So that's been a more recent area of focus.
Great. So there's some very rich ideas there, and also some quite foundational work. So that the CMOOC you mentioned there, well, fit for want of a better term to sort of contrast it with XMOOCs, has right. led into some fairly significant international work. And your early focus on learning analytics too has been followed up by a number of others around the world. So for you, that the step into analytics came from that first CMOOC, once you saw that big data start coming through.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, few things in a network world are singular source, but definitely one of the interesting outcomes was there was early stage already. And I still remember it was after a couple of years after we had run the first MOOC, and we were starting to see just these large data sets from the log data, from the language and the discourse data as students socialized with one another, either in the discussion forum or across blogs and a range of websites where they had control of it. It suddenly, you know, this growing awareness that, wow, you know, there is an awful lot of stuff happening that we can use to advance sort of our understanding of learning, to advance the science of learning, the psychology of learning. And so that was definitely that, you know, the MOOC was the primary motivator. But there's also, as I said, in networks, there's not often a single point of impact. And so at the time, it was early on in this big spike in interest in big data. And it was really culminated, I think it was around 2010, 2011, that O'Reilly ended up running at their first big data conference. And that was sort of, in many ways, was a launch point. And I attended, it was the first event that they held. It was called the Strata Conference. It's about 600 people there. And what surprised me is they had a job board up. And I'd walk past the job board, and every major tech company in the Silicon Valley, this was held in San Jose, so sort of the heart of Silicon Valley, every major tech company had what was a job board, fairly large size job board, you know, a couple meters by a couple meters roughly. And, you know, the first day there was a few posts up by Apple and Google and Microsoft. And all of a sudden by the end of it, it was, you pick a company like Adobe and Yahoo, and everyone had postings up that was looking for data analysts or something comparable. Learning analytics was followed. We were already in the planning stage of the first learning analytics conference when I attended that Strata conference. But from there, it was really a sort of liftoff, because there was a sudden explosion in interest in what we can do, you know, around just basically, yeah, the same question, improving the quality of the learning experience for our students.
Yeah, great. Can I come back to the question of MOOCs? So the distinction between CMOOCs and XMOOCs, I mean, it's contested by some, but it's a reasonably helpful shorthand. The first MOOC that you provided with Stephen Downs was, of course, a CMOOC, a community or constructivist-based MOOC. What's your impression about the direction that MOOCs have now gone? It seems to be reasonably far from the vision that you and Stephen originally had. Are you able to comment a bit on that?
Yeah, that's a great point, and you know, and a good good sort of launch pad to a bit of ranting. But I think there's been a bit of change of heart from what I thought initially. Initially, it was like, look, there's this terrific opportunity to take this new platform to educate people who might not have access to learning opportunities. And more importantly, to make that point of giving them access also an opportunity for development for themselves, gaining control, gaining the ability to drive the conversation, beginning to impact how people learn, how people participate in society. So the motivation was initially quite strong in that category area. And then when I saw the MOOCs that were run by Stanford and Harvard and MIT, those had a very different angle. That focus was very much on traditional instruction, namely a faculty member tells you what you need to know when you do some activities and away you go. So initially, I think I was probably unrealistically dismissive of that type of an approach. I still think it's not the best way to go, but as I've met people in different parts of the world who've had access to these, for them, it's not a question of, is it a good pedagogy, or is it a good teaching and a learning model, or does it enable me to, or does it empower me? For many of them, it's actually much more a question of, does this give me access to something I wouldn't have in any format? And that, I think, was the big benefit of the edXs and the Future Learns and the Courseras, is that it enlarged the opportunity, not in the pedagogical model that I would hope, but at minimum, it provided a huge enlargement of opportunity. So I still see a difference between the two. One is really about creating people who are capable of ongoing, lifelong, self-regulated learning. And the other is much more focused on the short-term, learn how to do a particular task.
It's quite interesting reflecting on that, because the CMOOC style seems to actually reflect Athabasca's way of working as a university as well, doesn't it?
It does in a number of ways, with one, I think, exception is that there's still heavy control and influence on the part of the faculty member, meaning the faculty member still sets the outcome, still sets the objectives, still drives the bulk of the learning activity. And at the time that when I was at the University of Manitoba, you know, I wasn't familiar exactly with Athabasca's pedagogical model at the time. But when once I became more familiar with, there's certainly areas of overlap, namely social networked approaches to learning, a high degree of dialogue, a lot of Terry Anderson's pioneering work around the equivalency theorem of interaction, around communities of inquiry, and so on. It really reflected that there was also a growing group of individuals paying attention to how we learn when we engage in these kinds of complex online settings. But what was lacking at the Athabasca model, and I think any particularly formally structured system is the development of individuals' places of learning, development of a personal infrastructure where they control the learning opportunities and so on. I think that's really the key area that you need to see advancement of, especially in an age where we're forecast or anticipated to be perpetual, ongoing, lifelong learners.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, George, I had the privilege of discussing things with you face-to-face in Dublin last week. It would have been about 4 or 5 days ago, depending on how you count the jet lag there.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was great to hear your keynote. There's some very, very good lessons for us there. And I wonder if you can just talk a bit about that, your observations about online learning and education at the present time as we approach the end of 2019.
Yeah, and it was great to obviously see you and connect in person as well. I think the avenues of learning and digital learning right now are going through, I'm not quite sure we'd call it a little bit of a seismic shift, I think, at some level. We're starting to realize that there's an awful lot that's not quite right, even with networks and with network approaches to learning. There's a growing recognition, I think, that as we engage in these different kinds of learning opportunities, we are seeing a significant technological transformation. And what I mean by that technological transformation is the tools are beginning to shape us as much as we think that we shape them. And we're seeing that now with a lot of questions around bias. In data, we're seeing issues of social justice and equity and related problems that are now gaining recognition across large swaths of society. So I think from a learning end, we're facing that same challenge as what are we becoming? But now the question isn't sort of what are we becoming through the tools that we use. It's what are we becoming through how the tools use us? And that, I think, is a significant area of learning-related research. And I'm less interested currently. Doesn't mean it won't change, but I'm less interested in that sort of that tool fetishization that we had in the mid, probably from about 2000 to 2007 or 8, where the focus of learning and innovation was on the tools that we were using. Now the focus, I think, for me is much more around what are the broad set of related opportunities in terms of advancing and enabling longer-term potential. So it's not is it VR or AR or mobile learning or new software? It's much more about how does it influence sort of the social, the affective, the emotive dimensions of being human. So I think for now, when I look at the state of digital learning, especially going forward, the interest is much more on those intangible things that remain uniquely human when more and more of our activity, whether it's personalized learning or adaptive learning or, you know, recommendations when we shop online or friend recommendations in social networks, we're starting to realize now that not all of those environments are neutral. They produce a negative impact, not only a positive impact. And so that's my interest from a digital learning space is to turn more so to that dimension, the human, the social, the emotive dimensions.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, after your keynote, a few of us were talking about what you were talking about there. And it seemed that you were bringing quite a strong philosophical bent to the conversation, more along the lines of ontological development through education, which was really quite intriguing. So education is more than just knowing more, but actually becoming more.
Yeah, and I mean, I, again, part of the reason for that focus is being confronted increasingly daily with announcements of, oh, this new algorithm can outpredict the presence of cancerous tissue from a human doctor, or, you know, this scientific discovery was made through mining massive data sets. It wasn't done through a hypothesis-driven approach to science. And the list goes on. We see almost a daily sort of breakdown or listing of things that machines do better than us. And then at some point, well, our role as educators is first and foremost to prepare the next generation to inherit the world, so to speak. And when that world starts to look very different, at least conceptually and theoretically right now, than the one that we navigated through, then it starts to, you need to ask questions around, you know, what should we be teaching then? And what are the needs to inherit that world or to that we have to develop in our students? It's not enough to teach them chemistry and physics anymore, because in many ways, the systems and technologies that we use will be able to outperform humans in those areas. So it's unsettling. Even now, as you think about it, it seems woefully inadequate to say that that's the role of universities. And yet, when I'm looking at, well, what else are universities going to do in the long run? I'm not talking about a shift next week. I'm talking about a longer term shift. I mean, we can't just be places that train people how to work at a consulting firm or how to work at a huge tech company. Universities have to do more than that and have to be more of an agent within society as a whole. And hence my turn to thinking about the beingness attribute, or, you know, the term you use, the ontological dimensions.
I think it might segue into the next question. I'm not sure. I don't want to sort of preempt your response. But if you had an unlimited research budget and the ability to apply your mind to any particular research track you'd want to, what would you do? What research would you most like to see or be involved in at the moment?
Well, it does actually segue quite nicely to what you were just talking about, from a few different angles. So one, I think at its broadest level, I would be interested in the opportunity to better understand how human and artificial cognition build knowledge and impact society. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that that's where all forecasts based on government investments and resources and so on are being placed. And it's viewed as a key future survivability dimension for leading countries. You have individuals such as leaders of Russia stating that, you know, whoever wins the AI race wins the world. Overstated or not, it's a sentiment that's broadly held by leadership globally. China has enormous investments in AI. UK has developed their own AI strategy. European Union has. US developed one under the Obama administration, but has sort of handed off much of its fulfillment to the corporate sector. And you know, major places like Australia have framed their own AI approach and so on. So at the end of the day, we're looking at, it's an AI-centric world. It's something that we need to be conscious of. And so understanding how then do we relate to the machine? You look at major countries globally. They're seeing AI as a key competitive strategy. And in order to address that key competitive strategy issue, and that's like economically, militarily, governmentally, this is where they're staking their claim. Now, because of that heavy focus, we're seeing AI impacting all aspects of society, but it's going to be an uneven impact. And much of that impact leaves us with a key question of, where's the human being in this whole equation? And that's to your bigger question, what topic area would I look at? That would be it, the human artificial cognition angle, with an emphasis on specifically what is the unique dimensions of being human in this kind of a setting or in this kind of an environment.
Great, fascinating research, which actually transcends, if you like, online education, but it's very much a part of being an online citizen.
It really is, and it's related to, you know, the AI system and you know, the way that we build knowledge, the way that we work, which is a learning related dimension, is heavily based on our interactions with technologies and what those dynamics look like. So it is broader than learning, but it's still not irrelevant to learning.
George, I'm looking forward to your response to this one. Two people you'd recommend as legends and leaders of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now, and one who you think otherwise might have an important perspective to share.
Well, you know, I've done a lot of work with Stephen Downs traditionally, so he's someone that I would certainly recommend as definitely someone that resonates with my thinking and has impacted me. Another one is Audrey Waters, and I appreciate Audrey for providing a voice that has long sort of bucked the trends of big tech and started doing it well before it was cool to do so. And right now, there's a lot of people who are criticizing technology companies, but when she first started down this path about 6 or 7 years ago, she was very much one of a few voices in the landscape. So she's definitely someone I would put on that category of critical thinkers these days.
Excellent. Well, George, thank you. You're a highly innovative practitioner of online education. You're certainly a leader and legend. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Mark. Always great to catch up, and it was good to see you a few days ago, actually, in Dublin.
Great, thanks.
You can learn more about George and his work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.